Chapter 20, Death by Mom Jeans. January 2009. I swear I thought I looked beautiful. Maybe that's what hurts, and still hurts, the most. That I had no idea I was about to become a global joke. I was still flying from how well the tour with Rascal Flatts had started the night before. I had forgotten how much I loved to tour, to get up and sing in front of 15 to 20,000 people. We had sellout crowds, with our grosses competing with the only other acts that were drawing those numbers, established bands like Fleetwood Mac, Van Morrison, and Billy Joel touring with Elton John. I was so appreciative of the Flats for the opportunity, but I was also, for the first time in, well, my life, content to be in that now. I had a cherry red journal for the tour, and the first pages are filled with joy and a sense of relief that I had regained my self-confidence. "I just feel as if I'm right where I'm supposed to be," I wrote in South Carolina on my fifth night of the tour. The best part about the certainty of this happiness is taking a bit of pride in knowing that I am starting to own my authentic self and trusting my faith to guide my travels. We beat ourselves up too much. We have nothing to prove to anyone, not even ourselves. Oh, sweet girl, what I would give to hug you. It seems ridiculous now, and over the years I've spun the story of the incident and I retell it for maximum laughs. Of course it was a chilly cook-off, I joke. Anything to hide the humiliation I truly felt. You can't get a better headline. My kids' generation will read that once upon a time, Jessica Simpson wore a sleeveless black bodysuit top, high-waisted blue jeans, and a Fendi leopard print belt on stage at an outdoor afternoon concert in Pembroke Pines, Florida. And they will have no clue how that could have started a decade-long international discussion about my body. Or why the media ran stills and slow-mos of me smiling on stage and twirling, images examined like the film footage of the Kennedy assassination. On TV and in magazine, pundits would be asked to guess my weight and size, then in the exact same segment or article talk about what a shame it was that I was being so bullied. "Can't kick. This girl punch. Catch a break." But let's go back to the before and just be with that happy girl for a minute. Should we tack down the pocket? This was my childhood friend Stephanie, who was helping style me for the tour. We were backstage at the concert and I was about to go on in front of 30,000 people. Stitching it down quickly would make sure there was no bunching. "Nah," I said, looking in the mirror. "I might want to work the pocket." I was having such a good time touring that I liked the spontaneity of digging my hand in my pocket to brace myself for a high note. The choreography was looser than the second-by-second scripted movements of a pop concert. Kick, ball change, look serious as the firework effect hits stage right. Now smile for the Jumbotron close-up. It was so freeing to move how the music wanted me to. Stephanie had a plaid button-down ready if I wanted to do an open shirt thing. But I said no. My hair was big and southern with dangly double hoop gold earrings. I did one last look in the mirror and I loved what I saw. I bounded out to the crowd who received me with so much love and it just made me even happier. I did an hour-long set and got conversational as I introduced the songs, playing some old hits and the new country songs. Before You're My Sunday, I talked about Tony, who I was getting on a plane to Dallas to see that night. "I'm so happy," I told the audience, meaning it. I got off stage and did a meet and greet in a tent in the back of the park. 25 fans won the 99.9 Kiss Country Radio contest to meet me, and I made my way over the grass in my Alexander McQueen platform pumps. I posed for tons of photos, and almost every person got around to saying that they were glad I was so happy. They knew I hadn't been, and we shared that moment of grace, being together in a good place. The first photos were up on the internet that afternoon and everywhere by the time I was back in Dallas. They were mostly taken from below, and there just were so many of them. As if whoever was choosing couldn't pick a favorite and just said to the American public, "Here, enjoy." The equivalent of your frenemy tagging unflattering photos of you on Facebook, only times a million. Bloggers and commenters started in with "just got fat" jokes right away. Then mainstream sites picked up the stories with headlines about my new body and showing off my curves. It was awful, but the worst part was this. My very first thought was not my pain and becoming a joke and everyone laughing at me. No, it was, oh no, I feel bad that Tony has to be with the fat girl. What was he gonna do when he saw this? Was he gonna break up with me? Did he feel that way about my body and just didn't know how to tell me? He didn't. He loved me for me, and he also thought the whole thing was ludicrous. But I was devastated and confused. I had been really feeling it that day on stage, comfortable after such great gigs on the road with the Flats, finally back in my element. I think that's part of why people made so much of those photos. I looked like the girl invited to the dance as a joke, fooled into thinking everyone wanted her there. Doesn't she know? How was she the last to know? I was Carrie at prom, right before the pig blood fell. Magazines and websites ran side by sides of me in a bikini as Daisy Duke and in the jeans. It was funny. Whenever I saw those bikini pictures, I saw Daisy. I didn't see Jessica. And then there were these new pictures that didn't have much to do with me either. Wonder Woman herself, Linda Carter, had tried to warn me of this very thing all those years ago. I remembered her words. People are going to want you to be in those Daisy Duke shorts the rest of your life, she said. She knew what it was like to be frozen in the amber of pop culture minds. I didn't realize how right she would be. I had created the gold standard Jessica, the before for every is she fat or is she thin story for the rest of my career. I had always been in on the joke, and that gave me power. Now that it was everybody else making it, I didn't think it was funny. I was insulted for myself and all women. Here's the thing. Women are beautiful at any size. I believed that, and still I had dieted for years, taken who knows how many diet pills. I did that because I thought that's what it took to be a success in the music industry and in Hollywood, but I didn't want anyone else to hold themselves to that impossible standard. I wish I hadn't. So I wouldn't tell anyone that the jeans were a size 25 waist, which is an American 4. I wouldn't go on talk shows to say I was about 120 pounds when those photos were taken. The media guesstimated much higher numbers. The fact that I was that skinny and that I was deemed overweight still frightens me. No way was I going to go out there and turn on my sisters by saying, oh no, you're mistaken. It was the angle and the fit. I'm actually a size 4. What would that do to my young fans who may have been a size bigger or 20 sizes bigger? My publicist Lauren got so many requests for photo shoots and sit-down interviews to set the record straight. It seemed like negotiating with a hostage taker. If I disavowed having a regular body, nobody would get hurt. Except everybody would get hurt. We refused the request, unwilling to play into the game of shaming women. The story just kept going. The New York Post gave me a new nickname, Jumbo Jessica, and the media declared that I was a cautionary tale about mom jeans. There were fashion pages about how to avoid looking like me. Page 6, the gossip column everybody in the media read, ran a cartoon of me with my features ballooned to represent every cruel stereotype of a person of size. It showed me dumping Tony to be with my true love, Ronald McDonald. That caricature became how I saw myself. Even as I tried to remain body positive about everybody else, a dysmorphia set in. I no longer trusted the mirror. With every reflection, every single pane of glass I passed, I took myself in quickly to try and catch myself, to see what the world apparently saw. The worst part was that I had to get up in front of thousands of people in Charlottesville 4 days later for another tour stop. My confidence was gone, and Stephanie and I rethought my entire wardrobe. What could invite people to make fun of me? I instinctively added a black vest, just like my days of performing at church camps as a kid, when my body was continually scrutinized for the potential incitement of sin. The rest of the tour, Instead of enjoying the sold-out audiences, I was conscious of people taking pictures, reporters eyeing me, taking notes. What were they seeing that I didn't? It made me shrink on stage. My mother worried about me, knowing that my self-confidence had been taken away. She saw me withdrawing, not fully present. I was the same girl who had refused to go to school because the cheerleaders were cruel to her. Now, instead of graffitiing our house, it was people commenting on every image of me. 90% of women go through this, I promise you, she told me. You just have it on a whole different level. Why are people so cruel? I asked. I may as well have been in my old bedroom in Richardson refusing to get dressed for school. She didn't have an answer, so she went to the go-to every mom uses with their daughter at one time or another. They're just jealous. I couldn't do anything about the media focusing on me, but I hated that I was so focused on me and my body. I had grown so much since I was that girl who'd pinched herself black and blue in 1999 because I had the smallest jiggle. I no longer needed to draw on abs with eyeliner. And here I was, still looking for the flaws. Old enough to know better, and unable to stop myself. Still, I had enough sense not to go on some crash diet, or worse, stop eating in order to fit the media's view of what was beautiful. In those months, I can probably count on one hand the public moments when I forgot how much everybody was looking at my body, judging me. I was in the line, a TSA flying out to LA to do some work on the collection. I set off something when I went through the metal detector and I got flustered. A female agent did a pat down of my body. When it was over, she smiled at me, so I smiled back. "You're really not that big," she said. "Thanks," I said. "Jess," I thought as I walked on, "that's not a compliment." I turned back. "I'd be fine if I was, though." It took me a while to not just say those words, but believe them. Like a lot of life lessons, I was able to incorporate some aspects of what I learned right away. Some took longer. It certainly informed how I expanded my clothing line. The collection needed to stay inclusive as we branched into jeanswear and dresses. And our showroom always had to have fit models who reflected the full range of the customers I loved. I always wanted to dress the everyday woman, because I am an everyday woman. I want to wear the same things that everybody else wants to wear, and I wanted to be able to provide those things for people. To be the friend you go shopping with who gives you a thumbs up when you come out of the dressing room because she genuinely wants you to look and feel good. The silver lining of the mom jeans debacle was that I felt women trusted me more, because now they saw what I was going through. When my time on the Rascal Flatts tour was over in March, I found that my feelings of insecurity stayed with me, even when I wasn't on stage. Mom and I scheduled an appearance to promote the Jessica Simpson collection at a Dillard's in Scottsdale, Arizona. When I arrived at my hotel room, I had some quiet time while everybody got settled in their rooms. But I resisted, because downtime at that point usually meant picking myself apart. I grabbed a remote and flipped the channel, only to see a photo of me in those high-waisted mom jeans next to a more recent picture of me on stage. They said I had gone on a crash diet and lost 20 pounds. I switched off the TV. "Why won't people leave me alone?" I asked the empty room. This little tiny whisper of intuition answered. A voice from within spoke up. "It's okay to not be left alone," it said. "The moment people leave you alone, it will be because you stopped standing up for yourself." I got chill bumps. The truest voice is always that one inside you. I wouldn't give in. There was a long line of people at that appearance, and I always watch my team fade ever so slightly from standing around at these types of events. I don't help things by taking too much time chatting with each person as I sign a photo or the heel of a shoe, but I love those moments of connection. A woman who'd waited at least an hour finally got to my table and started to rush talk at me as if she had rehearsed what she had had to say the whole time and had to get it out. "I just have to tell you that you really saved one of my students." "Who?" I asked. She slowed down and said her name. "She's a great girl, but she was really getting..." She paused. bullied. She said it like it was her failure as a teacher. It was about her weight. It's eighth grade, so kids can be, you know. I could stop it in my classroom, but not outside. She was just so sad. I could feel my whole team leaning forward, listening as she continued. Her mom told her about you, and she feels something akin to you. I asked her about it, and she said that because of you, she knows she can get through it. Soon, we were all tearing up. I stood up and said, "If I give you a hug, will you give it to her for me?" This was why people wouldn't stop their judgments and leave me alone. It was so I could stand up to them, and for that girl. When the world was trying to knock me down, to challenge who I was as a woman and the ownership I had over myself and my body, I could choose to get back up and be right in their faces, to say what I would want that girl and my daughters and all women to say. No, actually, I'm beautiful because I believe in myself and everything God has given me. I'm not saying it's easy. It's sometimes a daily struggle. But you gotta get up. You can't leave me up here all on my lonesome. I could tell Tony was relieved when the flats tour was over. He was a traditional guy who believed in old-fashioned gender roles. He wanted me to be a Dallas Cowboys housewife, even without the ring. I spent more time at the home, which he encouraged me to think of as my own, but it was still as much of a frat house as ever. In interviews, when people got through the required questions about my weight, they turned to asking about my next project. I said I was still deciding, not letting on that my boyfriend didn't want me on a movie set. I think he was fine with me doing the Jessica Simpson collection. It certainly made me financially independent from him. But maybe he also saw that as women's work. A more official version of a girlfriend who has a hobby making dresses for her friends. I was in a bind. Tony liked dating Jessica Simpson, the star, but he wanted a wife like the other football players had. I cooked the meals at home and went to the grocery store, where I saw my face looking out at me on the covers of magazines at the checkout line. I never identified with those magazine covers anyway, but now they seemed even further from who I was. One time after I saw myself on a magazine when I was leaving the store, I went to sit in the car and had an imaginary conversation with Tony. I asked him all the questions I didn't dare say aloud. "Is there room in your ideals of what a relationship is supposed to be?" I asked. "To meet me halfway so I don't give up my dreams?" I watched a teenager round up shopping carts leaning on one like a jet ski. "Can you support me in what I do as much as I support you in everything you do?" I was on a roll now. "Is my giving up all I want to do truly what you want of me?" I paused a long time. And why? It didn't occur to me that I needed to ask myself those questions, too. Did I love Tony enough to give up my work and dreams? I didn't dare ask because I knew the answer was no. I talked about it with my father, who wanted to do more film producing and would jump at the chance to do another movie with me. I was honest with him, telling him that I would marry Tony if he asked, but I wasn't sure if I wanted him to ask me. I wanted to be what Tony needed, but I felt God had called me to use my voice and be an example for women. "Well, the same God that called you to sing is going to want you to do that," he said. "Maybe you need to walk away." It didn't help that my parents told me they'd been hanging out with John Mayer. It was so bizarre. In early 2009, John rented a place in Hidden Hills, near where I used to live in Calabasas. He turned the whole place into a home studio to record what would become Battle Studies. It was about 14 miles from my parents' house in Encino, and they told me about having him over. They would even go pick him up to spend time with them. Gated community playdates. At first, I thought they were kidding, but he had stayed friends with Pete Wentz and Ashley, still. He told them he read my Vanity Fair cover story that came out in May. My parents told me he went on and on about it. He emailed me about it too, telling me how amazing it was and that he loved me and wanted me back. Because I was on the cover of Vanity Fair? I actually hated the story, which was mean-spirited and full of references to me not actually being fat, a word the writer used over and over again. and had one brief mention of the fact that I had created what was at that point a $400 million business. But the photographs by Mario Testino were beautiful. It was telling that being in Vanity Fair made John think I was worthy of his interest again. I also said one thing in the interview that reading it now, I know would have been irresistible to John. I feel like I'm at such a place that I own myself and it's authentic. Challenge accepted, I imagine him saying. My parents knew how much John had toyed with me, and even now I marvel that he could extend that manipulation to my family. I recently asked my mom why she spent time with him. What were you thinking? We were all in love with him, she said with a laugh. We'd bring him over here and sit around the fire pit and he'd play his guitar. What's not to love about a cute guy playing you love songs? Sigh. They were under his spell. I can't really blame them. I know how persuasive he can be and how kind my parents can be. But I refused to let him have that real estate in my mind again and focused on figuring out how to make my life work with Tony's. I was turning 29 in July and every magazine said he was going to propose any minute. Maybe John read one of them and thought so too. As we got closer and closer to July and my birthday, he ramped up his wooing of my family. He told them in no uncertain terms that he had changed, and he could tell that I had changed too. I need her back, he said. I'm in love with her. If it were just my parents, I might have taken that with a grain of salt. But he got to Beth, my old dance teacher, who had become one of the heads of the Jessica Simpson collection, and her husband, Randy, who is now my house manager. Randy is no nonsense. If you can fool him, you're a master. And Randy believed him. His profession of love for me was so over the top that it made my relationship with Tony seem like I was missing out on someone who truly adored me. Jessica, you don't even know, went the chorus. He is just so sincere. You have to at least hear him out. Can I sigh again? Is two too many on two pages? A week before my birthday, I was in LA at my parents' house. I had this idea to have a huge party, and my mom and I were going over the details. My dad drove to Hidden Hills to bring John over while I was there. By a fire in the backyard, he stood and told all of us that he loved me and we could all trust him to be a good man. I told him I would always love him, but I was with Tony. But I didn't tell Tony. I broke my own rule of full disclosure about any contact, even accidental, with John. On July 9th, the night before my birthday, Tony went through my phone. He saw an email from John to me, something about not being able to get the shower door to work at my parents' house. Tony confronted me with it immediately. I wasn't even there, and no, I still don't know why John showered at my parents' house. He accused me of seeing John behind his back. I hadn't cheated on Tony at all, but I could not lie and say I hadn't even seen him. Nothing happened, I said. Tony didn't believe that for a second. And within that second, he broke up with me right there. 2 years gone with an email. It was just immature that he went through my phone. If he didn't trust me, why was he with me in the first place? I could trust that Tony would never tell the press that John Mayer caused the breakup. It would imply that he wasn't enough for me. Even though I canceled the party, I managed to keep the breakup a secret for a few days. I think maybe I would have been able to keep it quiet longer if Tony had just gone back to Dallas. Instead, he stayed to go golfing with his friends and took his guys out to a Hollywood Boulevard club on my birthday. Kind of a red flag. Tony soon realized I was telling the truth. Of course, I didn't cheat on him. But our breakup had been so ugly that it shocked me into realizing that it had been necessary. When he said he wanted me back, I was honest with him. No, you did what I needed to do, I said. Thank you. This is really over? You broke up with me, so yes, I said. It's over. If I hadn't already gone through that cycle so many times with John, I might have reflexively gone back once someone forgave me. Tony's a wonderful guy, and he was destined to have beautiful babies with someone else, a lovely woman. Not me. John got what he wanted. I wouldn't be with him because of Tony, and now Tony was gone. I lost my feeling of agency in my life once again and felt I should just give in and be with John. He had promised forever in my parents' backyard. Who was I to argue? I went to John's house quickly. Driving over, I felt like I was in the closing scenes of a sweeping epic love story, and the dark romantic hero had beaten out the star quarterback. Wuthering Heights and Hidden Hills. Only this time, Kathy chose Heathcliff. But did I? It seemed like the choice had been made for me. But when I got to him, I found out my Heathcliff had other ideas. Forever could wait. "Oh, you don't get me yet," he said. It was a punch in the gut. I thought I was the one getting gotten. He had said all these things, practically asking my parents for my hand in marriage while I was in a serious relationship, swearing to me up and down that he was a changed man. Now here I was, ready to pledge my love back and to kiss him as the curtain came down, and it fell on my head. He insisted on playing me songs off Battle Studies. "This one's for you," he said, again and again. I recognized myself sometimes. Other times I just felt the hurt again. I named a person he had dated. Weren't those songs about her too? He paused, then told me he could never find material to write with her. I almost puked. I was material. Slowly, insidiously, a realization creeped into me. A monster with claws clutching my brain with one hand and making a fist around my heart with the other. All this time, all those years, he was breaking up with me to torture himself enough to get good material. "Were you breaking up with me to hurt yourself?" I asked. "Just so you could get a song?" I had thought I was crazy. There were times he left, and it was my fault. And I have taken responsibility for those moments. But other times, a breakup was so out of the blue that it seemed to come just as we were finally getting somewhere. Now I knew the truth. I was a pet bird. He would throw me into the sky and watch me catch air and soar long enough that it meant something when he pulled a gun from his back pocket to shoot me down, expertly aiming to graze a wing. Never a kill shot to end the misery. To think that every single time I lay on the ground, broken and bewildered, he took his time walking over, observing me to jot down notes and hum a new song of heartbreak. And every time he found me, I looked up at him, grateful to be taken in, sorry for the trouble I must have caused him. I wish I had walked out right then. I didn't. He had me so messed up that inside 20 minutes, I was all in on his wait-and-see terms. It felt inevitable to be in love with John. So I continued talking to him for months. I told friends I was back with him, and they stocked up on emotional bandages. But I knew now not to let him get close enough to shoot me down again. This bird wasn't going back in the cage, no matter how bad he needed a song.